Welcome to the third and final instalment of the Insurers podcast interview with Dan Glaser, the President and Chief Executive of Marsh & McLennan Companies. If you listened to the first two sections, you would have heard Dan discuss a wide range of pressing industry issues emerging from the COVID-19 crisis, including the various different proposed solutions to future public-private pandemic reinsurance, the potential capacity crunch, capital adequacy, and the policy wording disputes that have emerged in both the US and Europe. In this final section, we look at the dilemma facing Lloyd's and whether it should reopen the physical trading floor. And we also examine why MMC has taken a different approach to managing costs compared to its great rival Aon. But I begin by asking Dan why he remains confident that his broking businesses will continue to see organic growth in 2020.
Well, there's a couple of things. One, you know, it's an incredibly resilient business with a lot of recurring revenue. And when I say it's resilient with recurring revenue, companies will continue to buy insurance. They may buy it differently. They may have a different attachment point. They may do some different things. But generally, companies will continue to buy insurance. Actuaries will continue to evaluate retirement plans. Life continues, even in crisis. And so I think the risk and insurance segment, what we refer to as RIS, has a shot at generating growth for the year. And I think back to the financial crisis. Now, I have to say every crisis is different and unique. And COVID-19 in a lot of ways is worse than the financial crisis. But the world is in better financial shape and is more resilient than in 2008 and 2009. Marsh & McLennan is a stronger firm than we were in 2008 and 2009. So it's not a parallel, but it's at least something that creates a data point. And when I think about 2009, which was RIS's worst year in memory, it was -1 underlying growth for the year. And so, you know, specifically at Marsh, yes, exposure units are down considerably, but rates are up. And in Guy Carpenter, you know, we were saying we expected to see mid-single digit growth for the year, with a stronger first half. And you know, a lot of it is driven by, well, what's business confidence like and what is general economic conditions. And so our outlook was pretty much geared on the basis that there was going to be a steep decline in the second and third quarters, particularly in the second, in the general economy, and that, you know, in the third quarter there would be the gradual movement toward normalization. Not normal, still recessionary conditions in the third quarter and in the fourth quarter. The other thing is the insurance industry tends to operate on a lag, right? Because you've got annual contracts. And so it takes a while for that to work in. So I feel, you know, confidence too strong a word in a time of such high uncertainty. But I'm absolutely optimistic, even though cautiously optimistic might be a better way of putting it, that we've got a good shot in RIS to have revenue growth for the year.
Thank you, Dan. You've also spoken out against the idea of sort of salary reductions or cuts at MMC. I mean, what are you using any sort of levers to tighten belts and manage expenses through this economic downturn? And perhaps just to clarify, I mean, what presumably you considered the idea. Why did you sort of rule it out?
Yeah, so it's a good question. You know, it started from the basis that our first decision as an executive committee was that we were going to put the health and well-being of our colleagues first. We recognized, even in that initial conversation, that every company was going to say something similar. And when I say every company, I'm not talking about any of our competitors. I'm talking about every company in the S&P 500. It's the easiest thing to say in the world that our colleagues come first, okay? Yeah. We decided that we weren't going to say it, we were going to do it. And so from that became our North Star, and every decision we've been making since has used that North Star as a way to guide us. And you know, when I said before that our business is defensive and resilient, it's true, but we're not immune. I mean, we get impacted by economic results, and in most economic scenarios, we would tend to do better than the S&P 500 because of our level of defensiveness and resilience. But you asked about whether we put other policies in place, and yeah, I mean, we quickly put policies in place to reduce non-essential expenses, and we set a very high bar for what essential really was, and a lot of things dropped away. And so, you know, very quickly, we moved to dramatically cut back on temporary employees, contractors, overtime. We've curtailed marketing, we reduced capital expenditures. Of course, T&E has fallen off a cliff because nobody's traveling and there's very little entertainment going on. And so, you know, we pulled a lot of levers to reduce our expense base. And in more severe scenarios, we would pull other expense levers, and we have additional levers at our disposal in terms of hiring, because we have not created a hiring freeze as of now. We're being more cautious around hiring, but we certainly don't have a freeze. Bonus, other expenses. I mean, we've got plenty of levers. The one thing that I said on the first quarter call is we're not going to be late pulling a lever, you know, but importantly, we're not going to be early and do anything that can cause lasting damage to the business. And in our view, salary cuts coupled with dividend cuts would be the last lever. And frankly, we do not think it's going to be necessary.
That may be a neat segue into a proposed transaction or agreed transaction that's taking place in our universe, which of course is the Aon WTW deal. And that's led to a number of concerns from some clients of the industry about sort of choice and market concentration, perhaps in particular, actually, in the reinsurance space. You know, as a market leader, I mean, what are your views there, and how do you sort of assuage customer concerns in this regard?
Well, I wouldn't try to assuage customers' concerns about choice or market concentration, since the reality is the big three would become the big two. You know, the Aon Willis combo would necessarily reduce choice and competition in at least two ways. In the primary large account space across several lines and geographies, and as you mentioned, in reinsurance. So, you know, I'm not going to take the view that somehow we've got to tell clients that they have the same or more choice, or the same or less concentration, you know. So, but the important thing for me is running Marsh & McLennan is we're very focused on running our own race, and we're going to do everything possible to continue to focus on providing our clients with the best possible service and options. And we think that we're going to have a very bright future, regardless of what the competitive environment may become in the future.
There's been so many developments in the industry. It feels like a bit, particularly long time ago, that you agreed terms to acquire JLT, which, of course, completed a little over a year ago. That had a lot of focus on that transaction for reasons we were well aware of. What I'd be particularly interested in is, I mean, as the outcome 1 year and a bit on, has it met your expectations? Have things surprised you? I mean, if you know, to take a scorecard, how do you think the integration of the JLT deal has gone?
Well, that's one thing that COVID-19 did was I don't receive any more questions really about JLT anymore, particularly about, you know, hey, we got these three people who left in this particular location, and is that going to change the trajectory of your $17 billion company? And so I'm glad that a little bit more sanity has prevailed. And I can tell you, time will prove that the JLT acquisition, which in some parts was pure acquisition and in some parts was more like a combination, has been a resounding success. We welcome more than 10,000 talented people into our organization. We have more capabilities to serve clients. There's real power in the combination. And the need for specialist advice has never been greater as clients deal with the increasing size, complexity, and range of business challenges. COVID-19 just points to that kind of issue, but it can be other things into the future. Now, we learned an awful lot about integrating activities over the course of the last decade, which has helped us, you know, with regard to JLT, which was the largest acquisition in our history. We just had a terrific year. I mean, a remarkable year all things considered, in 2019, considering we were doing all of this integration work and our performance was really strong as well. And I put that down to the quality of the executive team and the commitment of the colleagues to, like, let's get it done. Let's pull together and get it done. And so all of our efforts were to combine the best aspects of each organization. But talk is cheap. So I would say, what do the numbers say? So look at the first quarter, 5% underlying growth, 5% at Marsh, 7% at Guy Carpenter, 5% at Mercer, but 8% in health and benefits at Mercer, which is the part where JLT gave the biggest contribution into Mercer, was on the health and benefits side. And I've said a couple of times before on Wall Street conversations that in most circumstances over stretches of time, looking at a competitive group of companies at what their comparative underlying growth is an important metric. But there's some periods of time where it's actually just as important or even more important to look at GAAP results. And in the first quarter, RIS was up 20%. Our revenue was up 20%. And that really is the combination with JLT. Our adjusted operating income was $1.17 billion. We've never made more money in a first quarter in our history. And our adjusted operating margin was up 80 basis points to 27%. So we had a terrific first quarter, which was really the last quarter where we were lapping JLT because we had closed on April 1st of the prior year. Yeah. So I feel terrific about where we are. It couldn't have gone better, and I think we'll prove it over time.
Thank you, Dan. And just a few sort of final questions, really looking at COVID-19 and what the sort of implications are for the industry and the way it operates. And perhaps the first one is, you know, workplace practices. You know, we're all working from home. It appears that the industry overall, at least, appears to have operated successfully in this kind of remote locations. And as you refer to, the advantage of travel and entertainment costs being much reduced, you know, on that basis, will the industry's kind of workplace practices ever return to the sort of pre-pandemic norm? Or do we think these changes will be long felt?
It's an interesting question. It's certainly, like in any crisis, there are opportunities that also appear. And I do think people are learning different ways of working, are far more digital than they thought they were. You know, frankly, from a Marsh & McLennan perspective, we have never been flatter, faster, or more connected than we are today. And so we don't want to lose any of that when we, you know, return to the office structure. I'm very careful never to say return to work because people are working harder than ever.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I do think some aspect of flexible work arrangements should persist over time, and that can help in a wide variety of different areas, giving people more flexibility, making them have higher levels of job satisfaction, improved outcomes for diversity, probably work-life balance, reduction in environmental impact. So there's all kinds of different ways. And when I say work-life balance, I'm not necessarily saying that people will work less. I'm just saying maybe they'll get back a couple of hours a day where they were just in the daily grind of getting to work.
Yeah.
You know, and so it really does free up a lot of time. And I think some of that is here to say. I mean, virtual technology works incredibly well. And we have had good levels of connectivity, not only with our colleague base and underwriters, but with clients as well, which should reduce the necessity of travel. Now, will there be face-to-face meetings and travel requirements in the future? Absolutely. But was the industry a little over the top of, you know, you got to fly to Singapore to go to that meeting and then you're going to end up later in the week in Chile? Well, yeah, the industry was a little over the top, and I think that there'll be some more sanity. But, you know, to sum it up, from my view, it's going to be more flexible, more digital, more agile work environments.
Thank you, Dan. And actually, continuing on that theme, but just focusing on the London markets and I guess in particular Lloyd's, which of course famously is a face-to-face market, but has also, I think by all accounts, coped well in this digital world and without face-to-face trading. So, I mean, on that basis, do you think Lloyd's should reopen the trading floor when, you know, when it's allowed to do so? Or do you think actually it should use the opportunity, I mean, if you were, you know, CEO John Neal, would you use this opportunity perhaps as a way to sort of cement electronic trading by you know, not opening the floor in the way that it used to be?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'm sure it's one that John will come up with the right response. You know, either way, I think the acceleration of digitization within Lloyd's, you know, is a fact, and that probably 2 or 3 years will be able to be leapt ahead in terms of where the industry can operate. And it's kind of an interesting theory. Should the room reopen? I mean, I'm a traditionalist. I was a broker for a long time. I like talking to people face to face, at least sometimes. And so I imagine what the room becomes over time is a hybrid, where the face to face becomes very specific, specialized, targeted, and in some ways unusual, and that electronic trading becomes more the norm. Because frankly, there's not a ton of activity in the room a year ago on high complex accounts being placed at the box. Most of that was being done in the office anyway. So, yep. You know, I do think that the likely scenario would be some sort of hybrid with a lean toward electronic over time.
Thank you, Dan. And I promise this is my final question. Looking to the future, and you know, a lot of the traditional boundaries that where they were comfortable with in the industry, reinsurers, insurers, MGAs, risk carriers, you know, a lot of these boundaries are beginning to break down, though, or certainly beginning to blur. But nonetheless, we have a clear distinction between you know, risk carriers on the one side and intermediaries and or risk advisors on the other. So on that basis, I mean, who do you think is sort of best placed to evolve with the market's needs in the future? You know, if you're going to advise a young, bright undergraduate to go into the industry, would you advise them to go into being an intermediary or to go into underwriting?
Well, for their career, I'd advise them to do both. It's just a question of which one should come first, you know, and so I do think that intermediaries and underwriters each have vital roles to play, each have all kinds of opportunity to grow the business, and that, yeah, there'll be cases where an underwriter sort of looks like an intermediary and will offer some solutions and some advice and maybe even some software. And there'll be certain cases where an intermediary kind of looks like an underwriter, and that's okay. You know, I think along the vast segments of the marketplace, there'll be different areas where intermediaries and underwriters work very closely together, but can also be adversaries in other areas. And I do think the roles are really vital. Wherever you are, though, on the insurance value chain, I think that there's two things that really are the most important, and that's focusing on the client experience. How does the client's job become easier? And in a lot of ways, I think that is simpler, fairer, broader policy language, perhaps at higher rating levels. I mean, you know, if it's broader, it's going to have to be higher rating levels. But I do think the client experience and the digitization of it and documentation, speed and accuracy of documentation, claims payment, which is more instantaneous and less adjudicated, are all part of improving the client experience. And I think also the second point is creating and sustaining innovation. And that's required of both intermediaries and underwriters. And I would just say that we should all remember that the best solution has yet to be invented.
Dan, we've run out of time, so this must bring to an end the insurer's special three-part interview with Dan Glaser, the president of MMC. On behalf of all my colleagues at the insurer, thank you very much for your time, and also thank you very much to you, the listeners, for tuning in. Look out for the next Best Policy podcast later this month. Thank you.